right. Pretty well, right on time here, I guess. Welcome to the digital technology session, first one today. And this is the second year we've done this, and I'm excited about some of the stuff that's going on in the digital technology area. Now, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, some of us had, you know, PCs at home, and companies had computers, and that's kind of how it worked. Now, everybody has a smartphone in their pocket, and there's millions of servers in the cloud supporting that and doing a lot of other stuff. The Internet of Things is the next thing. There'll be, you know, processors in the floors, the walls, the roads. What could go wrong? I mean, distracted drivers are driving around texting, but pretty soon they'll just be able to push the button that says auto drive, and there'll be no more accidents. So that's the brave new world we've got. So we've got six good talks today, and three in this session. I'm going to start out, and I'm going to be talking about the cyber problem. I'm going to take a quick look at history, most of which I experienced to remember, the outlook and possible responses. Okay, so, I mean, the computer revolution enabled the Internet, you know, for a lot of great things, but also gave us, you know, crashing 737s. You know, they're all parked over there, you know, waiting for somebody to approve the software. You got insecure, unreliable medical devices. You know, my father had one of those. And, you know, it could be attacked as well as it could fail due to a lot of problems there. You know, identity theft, I'm sure everybody's heard about. Credit card fraud, yeah, we've probably all had a card canceled here or there. And there's potential risk to the infrastructure, which I'll talk a little bit more about. And really the problem is that computers have become ubiquitous, and the software has become too complex to properly understand. You know, so the result, computers are really insufficiently reliable in ordinary use. You know, bugs can cause failures, but hackers can cause failures too, sometimes on a larger scale. The attacks are as ubiquitous as the computers, really. I mean, public anxiety, I think, in our society is often treated with theater. I mean, you know, if you look at the TSA baggage tests they do, you know, 67 out of 70 contraband things got through security, you know, in 2015. Computer antivirus is also theater, you know. It catches less than half of the attacks. I don't know if this, neither problem's really been solved. Okay, so here's my outline. We're going to zip through about 80 years of computer history, one chart for 10 years, because that's 20 minutes, and everyone's got to stick, especially the moderator and first speaker, stick to your time. Then we'll talk about excessive complexity and get some specific cyber tips and traps. And a little bit on the developer perspective. That's sort of, they're responsible for getting this in this fix, them and the pointy-haired bosses, and then conclusion. So the 40s, whirlwind, 1943, great hardware complexity. That's a lot of vacuum tubes. Those things would fail all the time. I don't remember this this one, but the software was relatively simple, but you know the hardware really limited the reliability on that. Now in the 50s, you know, mainframes were king. Operating systems never crashed. We got transistors replacing tubes in the TX0, which actually the MIT Lincoln Laboratory built, an organization I worked for 37 years. Reliability improved. You know, that's actually the console there at the lower right. This thing's not really. This is the console here, and there's a close-up. They actually put these transistors in little cases like a vacuum tube so you could plug them in, but they were pretty reliable. Now, Digital Equipment Corporation was founded in 1957. That's a picture of one of the mills there in Maynard, Massachusetts, where they were located. Now, in the 60s, more people programmed. You know, mini computers, so digital was really instrumental there. There's the very popular PDP-8 in the lower left. The basic language was invented. It was dial-up computing. The operating system still didn't crash, but I used BASIC in 1969. Over here, the CDC6600 was a very nice mainframe. I actually used one of those in the late 70s. Very nice 60-bit word computer. The 70s, we got networking and personal computing kind of showed up. You know, the ARPANET in around 1970 evolved into the Internet. I was on the Purdue University node in 76. I used to communicate with my brother. This was before email, but I'd send a file to a server at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He'd get it and reply. The protocols assumed we were all friends. But you know, the first spam email happened in the 70s. The lower right there, it was an ad for a DEX System 20 computer, and it was not well received. People really got upset at the first spam email. IMP there, interface message processor on the right, was what made the ARPANET work. And they told me it cost $70,000 a month for the communication line for that. I don't know if that was true. You know, Unix came along in 1975, and it had about 10,000 lines of code. The computer science students would take the source code home over the weekend, and they'd read it to kind of understand how operating systems ticked. I used that at Purdue for about 4 years. Now, the first personal computers, you know, one of them was the SWTPC 6800 there. It's a little hard to find these, but I know where two of them are. One's in the Smithsonian, and one's in my basement. In the 80s, you know, we really got PCs. You know, the IBM PC, very influential and really brought microcomputers even into business. And they were still pretty reliable. I used a system called CPM, a predecessor to MS-DOS, and I switched to Unix in 1988. But the first virus happened in the 80s, the brain virus from Pakistan, and there's some of the source code there. The floppy disks would be written with this thing, and then if you booted with that, you have the virus. You know, surviving attack then set a higher standard for software. It was trickier than just being reliable. In the 90s, the World Wide Web really took off, and malware took off as well. I mean, you know, Windows 3.1 is about 4.5 million lines of code. That's a lot of code. Windows 95, 15 million. The features were more important than reliability, so we learned about the blue screen of death, something we didn't have in mainframe days. You know, this didn't happen. Microsoft wasn't internet-centric or virus-resistant. I switched from Unix to Linux in 92 myself. It was free. It saved me $400. CD drives made boot sector viruses harder to do. And so you had email viruses. This Melissa virus is one of the very first. It's a macro virus. It attacked like a Microsoft Word. I'm using a PDF here, by the way, so I wouldn't be vulnerable to that. The 2000s, really, you got more complexity and more vulnerability. I mean, Windows XP, 2001, 35 million lines of code. Windows 7, 40 million. I mean, that's more lines of code than I've ever looked at, read, reviewed, or written in my life, or could, really. No one person really understands what that does. Web and email viruses really took off. Wireless became popular. That's another way to attack people. Wireless access points. Cell phone viruses around 2005. But, you know, the Stuxnet, if you don't know about that, you should Google that and check into it. You know, here's Ahmadinejad looking around with his guys in the facility, and they got all those anti-aircraft guns at the left, you know, in case the Israelis decide to bomb it like they do sometimes with those nuclear facilities. But the Siemens little control computer up at the top right is where the danger really was, and destroyed a whole lot of those rotating centrifuges. 2010s, even more devices and attacks. Zero-day attacks were prevalent. The zero-day means that 0 days have passed since people found out about this vulnerability. So antivirus doesn't know about it, and so it's useless. There's a black market in exploits, the dark web. There's ransomware. You've probably heard about that. You know, second floor to city pays giant ransom and to ransomware gang in a week. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars. Cyber powers using it to act for political means. I mean, you probably heard about the election of 2016 and the Brexit election and some of the stuff that's been going on. The Internet of Things, you know, I just want to briefly say, you're connecting everything. It's marketing because, you know, PC and laptop and tablet sales are flat. So you got to sell something. So it's tremendous promotion in the Internet of Things. There's a Nest thermostat over there. Google bought them for billions of dollars. I mean, you know, a Nest bug one time caused some homes to not be heated. It can freeze your pipes. The baby monitors, the pranksters love to just cuss out the babies. You know, they connect to it and they teach the baby all kinds of, the parents just go completely bananas. But I mean, it's maybe a little harmless, but it still shows a vulnerability. They do have your video. Hotel doors opening remotely. That could hit close to home, I guess, at this meeting. Let's just tell you about capitalism and security. You know, capitalism is the best way to build an economy. I mean, communism didn't cut it. I think everybody knows. But it's not a good way to minimize risks. You know, you can't determine if you're being slowly poisoned by the food you're buying at the grocery store. At least most of us can't. You have to have some regulation. And that feature of full equipment looks like a good idea, but it has risks. It's hard to write regulations for incredibly complex software, really hard. The license agreement says that it's absolutely not their fault. Nothing. You take all risks. the lowest bidder won't necessarily provide adequate security. Now, I found that out when the Office of Management and Budget outsourced security work. You know, I had the top secret clearance at the time to fill out periodically an SF-86 form. You're supposed to confess everything you've done, any drug use, affairs you're having, confess everything, and then they'll decide if you can keep your clearance. They won't tell anybody. You know, your secrets are safe with them. Well, you know, the government-sponsored hackers captured the entire database. There was a counterintelligence bonanza for China, and they took my information, even the fingerprints, as it says over there in the fine print. I got that letter right. There's some worthless credit monitoring there, those PIN numbers, you know. You know, that just kind of shows where we are. What about the power grid? You know, you hear about the power grid. If you haven't read this July 2017 Wired article on the Russian attacks on the Ukraine power grid, that's a really good one. I believe that's online. He suggests it's a dry run for a U.S. attack. You know, later that year, Fortune.com talked about hackers getting into our systems. A couple of weeks ago, the Senate passed this bill to decrease grid digitization and move toward manual control. When was the last time the Congress passed a law to go back to analog stuff or big switches, you know, instead of just computerizing and cell phone control? That shows somebody's paying attention. So I was excited to see that one. All right, excessive complexity. It really, you know, creates unreliable and insecure systems because you're just not sure how all that complexity is going to interact. You know, featureitis, I'm sure you know, in any like a word processing program, you add new features, but you never remove any because someone's going to scream about that. And if you don't use it, it's harmless, right? Well, maybe. Now, calling large software libraries is very commonly done. You know, in math, if you reduce part of a proof to a previously proven statement, that's a good way to make progress, even if the proof was incredibly complex. It makes the other proof easier to follow. But in software, you know, you call a large general purpose software library to perform some previously implemented function, you save development time, but you're executing that every time the code runs. It could involve thousands of lines of code with many, many arguments, picking the exact case you want, when the functionality could be provided for in a few dozen lines of code or less. So security, reliability, and performance can suffer a lot. You know, a good example is the cell phone app. One of my colleagues used to say that downloading cell phone apps is building sand out of sandcastles. Now, you know, if you need like a flashlight app, so there's an icon for one I downloaded one time. What does it do? Well, it turns on your flashlight, right? Well, no, that's minimal. The main thing is it's a free app. So the main thing is it communicates with a whole lot of advertising servers to deliver ads to you. And it tries to get as much information from you as it can when you install it, and then it sells your information to everyone it can. That makes for a very complicated thing. Now, if you can write simple custom software, that can help. You know, I had a few hundred JPEG images from a trip to Taiwan, and I wanted a program which would display them in a grid in my 4K monitor, you know, pretty big size. See the file name, date, and the GPS information, so I'll know for sure where I was. Took a look at my operating system file manager called Thunar and made the icons very large. That's as big as they got. It didn't meet my needs. There's no GPS info. It was a very large source code, so it's open source. I could take that. I could modify it, probably tens of thousands, if not 100,000 lines, to do what I want, but that's not easy. So instead, I wrote a 300-line script, essentially, in a scripting language, 300 non-comment, you know, non-blank lines. And if you look at this thing, you maybe can't see from there, but up at the top right, that's the complete user manual and reference guide there at the top, which says mouse button 3 or key D will move images to trash, mouse button 1 or key K will move images to special, Q will quit. That's all it does. It doesn't sell your information, and there's no internet connection whatsoever. That's more secure. Okay. So let's see, specific cyber tips and traps. We'll take a look at what to do, what not to do, and then a couple specific things, because it's always fun to hear what people do, especially paranoid engineers do. Sometimes we do some pretty funny stuff. You can't avoid all hackers, okay? It's like the old doctor joke, you know, doctor hurts when I do that. Really, if you get hacked when you do that, not doing that is probably, that could be the answer. Try to reduce your hacking footprint to be less of a target. Everyone is a target of script kiddies and criminal gangs trying to steal money from you, your credit cards, ransomware. If China is after you or Russia, you have very little hope. Don't ask me to save you. Just forget it. Don't make heavy use of known insecure systems, and certain attacks can be defended against, like ransomware. But I'm going to give a few examples. You don't hear me just say be good. We'll run through a few basic things that I do. On the financial, I'm a little paranoid on the cell phone. I don't do financial stuff there. I'm not a compulsive shopper, fortunately, so I don't do a lot of shopping on Amazon or anything. If you do want to get some money on your phone, buy one of these gift cards, you know, at the store, and then just enter the number in. That's as much money as anybody can siphon out of your phone easily there. I usually enter credit cards on my Linux desktop machine, and email is the only thing I really use it for, and text messages. I have a security freeze with three major credit agencies. You know, that's worth thinking about, because it's very hard to open accounts under your name. And this is the Equifax page over there. It says how to freeze and unfreeze. It costs you $10 to unfreeze if you want to get a new card. When you're traveling, you always bring two credit cards, because any time a credit card can be compromised, and they'll call you and say they canceled it, and we'll send you one home. And you say, yeah, I'm not home. That happened to me in Alaska. I did have two of them. Ransomware. It's really getting to be a bigger deal. It encrypts and holds your files for ransom. You can't prevent it, but normal precautions can help. You know, avoid clicking on strange attachments and going to strange websites. Stay off the porn websites. Hopefully I don't need to, emphasize that too much at this meeting, but that's where a lot of the stuff is. You have to have backups of important data to reload when this happens. You can't decrypt it. You either pay them or you have to have backups. Automatic backups, cloud backups, not necessarily effective. They can be back up your encrypted files, depending on how that's set up. You gotta be a little careful. What I do, offsite and offline backups, I have two backup drives and I back them up manually. I plug it in, back it up, unplug it. And I used to always take one to my dad's house to do cross backup. Back up his files to my drive and mine to his computer and then go home with it. Fortunately, he died 3 months ago, and I sold his house this week, so I need a new thing. I'm thinking about buying a little fireproof safe, maybe, and putting one in there and sticking it in the basement. Because it's good for not just for hacking and ransomware, but for fires, too. Your off-site backups, you're pretty safe there. Between backups, I email a new document, like this talk, maybe, to an IMAP account, like my Yahoo account, for example. Oh, that's SATA. That's just a data transmission method, a different type of a drive.
Okay, is it something that's available commercially?
Yeah. A lot of computers, you can plug into a lot of servers with that. It's like a USB, similar to USB. It's a little faster.
I'll inject one more place to put your backup, your safe deposit box.
Yeah.
The safe deposit box is above flood level.
Yeah. I'm retired. If you're doing more important work than me, then you may definitely want to consider that. Okay, passwords. You don't want to use the same password on two sites, but that's a little hard to do. But here's how I do it. I've got several words that I remember that contain upper, lowercase, and special characters represented by a single letter, like I have A and Y. But for example, what if you had F was the word finance with a capital F and an exclamation point for the I, and the word the letter R stood for ransomware with a capital R and a dollar sign for the S. Just remember those. Then, I have several numbers, like a 3 might be a 289, displacement of my first car, the Mustang engine. But then you can add a two-character salt to the front or back of your password. You just rotate through those salts so everyone is different. Then you can just write them down in a file and print the file. So like Facebook, R3Q1, I know that my salt's on the end, so the R is ransomware and the 3 is 289 and Q1. So I stick that one in. I can just print this thing. And, I have one with me here. So any site I want to get on, I can get on. Password managers have some merit. There's a computer program, generates complicated passwords for you and logs you into sites. But a keystroke logger could capture your master password. Those things have been hacked. My printed page, is pretty useless. It is on my computer, so I can print it, but it's sort of security by obscurity. It's not that valuable anyway. Password recovery is a key thing. This guy over here, he hacked Sarah Palin's email during the election, a couple of elections ago. using recovery questions. He just said, I forgot my email. So I said, where did you meet your husband? You know, he said, high school in Alaska, where it said on Wikipedia, Sarah Palin met her husband. They're often mandatory and used when you log in. So I make them up. They're always false, and I write them in my magic file here. These are right out of my file there. Favorite historical person, Jubal. Look them up in Genesis. Musicians are going to know who that was. Street you lived on it. There is no Sycamore Street in my hometown, actually. Dream job, high school math. Make it all up. Just write them down. Otherwise, people will be able to recover your password. Trust me. Just print it. Print now and then, you know. Old school. All right. The developer perspective. There's professional codes of ethics, like the ACM is the best known, computer science professional society. They have some great engineering code of ethics. The IEEE Computer Society, which I'm a member of, also has similar stuff, You gotta really prove software only if it's safe, meets specifications, so on and so forth. Disclose danger to the user, and so on and so forth. But, if you read these things at work, you don't have to join the ACM or even read the code of ethics. That's actually where I read those. The IEEE one I'm bound by. For Christian developers, these are some of my favorite verses for Christian developers. I mean, the first two are basically summarized by, St. Belichick of Massachusetts says, do your job. And that's kind of what those first two are. Do your job. Don't make insecure software because you're slacking off. But I love the James verse, not many of you should become teachers. And why is that? Clearly because you're going to multiply your misconceptions to dozens to hundreds of people. I mean, let not many of you become software developers because it's tens of thousands to millions of people. I think it's something to think about. Now, in management, anybody who's been in industry for 30 or 40 years like I was has been asked to do illegal or unethical things at some point. It has to have happened. But I think, managers who don't believe the risks are serious can be a bigger problem. And so we got to educate them. I'm trying to promote education here in ASA, but they may be correct. The benefit to them outweighs the risk, because not many managers ever have their heads roll because of these hacks. They should probably, some of them, but they usually don't. All right, in conclusion, our situation isn't good. Hubris and capitalism has really caused dependency on a lot of bad code. And attacks far more serious than election hacking could occur. And things that almost everyone does are completely insecure. So it is important to educate people. And I encourage you to educate yourself and whoever you run into who needs some of that. Corporations have policies. They know they need them, but the users tend to torpedo quite a few of them. If it's the boss, they're never subject to anything anyway. There's no punishment for them. basically I'm just saying not all hardware and software that can be developed should be developed. It's basically my conclusion. All right, that's it. Any questions?
Hello.
Back here.
Hi. Another trick is typing your true answer twice.
Oh, yeah.
I'm from Edmonton.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you want to try that.
Two-factor authentication, do you think they'll try
that? I didn't mention it. There's ways to hack the cell network. Some of the the really big guys are really hacking two-factor, I hear, But probably your script kiddies aren't going to do that, I use it for some sites that want it, but it can help. Bill?
You made some reference to the IEEE Code of Ethics.
Yeah.
What was it? I didn't get it.
What basically says that you should not be developing systems that are going to pose a risk to the public, and you need to, refuse to do that, do not use your engineering certification, and even alert the authorities, similar to the ACM. It's kind of similar, yeah. They're just revising that, actually. One of them is being revised. Is the ACM one? Or one of them was just being revised, but it's very similar. I have a chart on that, but I have 20 minutes, so I didn't bring it. It's in my 40-minute talk.
If I heard you correctly, you were arguing against the use of software libraries, whereas in reliable software, that movement would go the other way, because people who say, well, I can write it better myself, often don't.
Well, the fact of the matter is, if you want to write, say, 10 or 20,000 lines of code better yourself, well, you know, then you really got to think about it. But many people, like the JavaScript libraries are a good example. You know, in the JavaScript, there's some websites that deliver these big libraries and that you run the code when you're on your web browser. And it can be very slow, but one of them went down because there was some issues with the source code control, and tons of websites quit working because they were actually loading the software from this website. So the thing is, it's like a flashlight app, you know, or like displaying your pictures. If you can do it in 20 lines of code, I'm saying probably you should do it. If it's going to take thousands and tens of thousands, yeah, you want to reuse code when you can. But people just knee-jerk say, oh, they load this giant library in, and it's a problem. It is a problem. So it depends on where you draw the line, yeah?
I noticed you didn't talk about internet privacy much. Is that something that concerns you? Should people be getting VPNs?
Not as much as hacking, but it does concern me. Maybe I'll talk about that next year. We have a digital technology session. At the social media, it's one thing I took out too. I didn't talk about the social media, and that kind of connects to the privacy. Bob?
Tim, just one observation, I think, to the library question. I think sometimes, like maybe one example of where you might want to use the library that I've seen is like in applying cryptography.
Yeah.
Some of those types of things.
Yeah.
You just don't want to roll your own.
But that's a lot of lines of code. If you do roll your own, it's a lot of lines of code. You're trying to create a lot of complexity. Many times people use it when it's really very little. That and authentication, like web forms and things like that.
Yeah,
there's plenty of security things. Yeah, if you have it, you need a really big job, and the library does it. It makes perfect sense. But don't just say, oh, like in math, oh, it's been previously proved. You just reference that and you go on. You should think about it. That's what I'm saying, being intentional about it. Any more? Okay, Paul?
How about the power grid having its own separate internet? You mentioned manual, but, you know.
If
someone takes down the internet or the power grid, you can't even pump gas.
No. Well, if money's no object, there are definitely a lot of solutions there. But the fact is that a lot of these power guys want to be able to control the power plant from home when they're on the weekend. They don't want to have to come in. And so there's all kinds of back doors and things going on. So, if you pump enough money into almost anything, you know, I mean, we landed the Apollo on the moon with a very small processor. It's a very good code, very carefully written. And if we took that kind of care, we wouldn't be in this fix. Yeah. Okay, great. So we're going to move on to our second talk now.